everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass. It's time for another episode of It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me. Today we're going to be talking about invertebrates, insects, bugs. I've been thinking a lot more about these creatures ever since I spoke with Jonathan Balcombe a couple of months ago, the author of Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. I really enjoyed his book and that interview, and it's helped me think a lot more about these beings that we share our home, planet Earth. I'm trying to be a lot more mindful about them, a lot kinder. And it's funny because ever since we got home from our cross-country trip to California, there have been a couple of flies that have moved in with us. And as I'm talking to you now, one of those little flies is flying around my microphone, and he likes to keep me company a lot. I'm looking at this one particular fly a lot differently than I used to. There's this reaction. I want to say it's natural, but I don't think it's natural. I think it's learned to just swat and kill. Swat and kill. Get it out of your way and then whack it. I'm not doing that. I'm enjoying observing this little fly as it sits with me as I'm talking to you. It's really amazing. I'm not exactly sure what they're enjoying or what they're getting out of this process, what they're nourishing themselves with. I don't know, but I'm filling myself more with wonder than with annoyance that they're in the way, because they aren't in the way. They are the way. It's just amazing. As I'm talking to you, I'm watching this little guy swarming around the microphone and all of the wires and nuts and bolts here. Today we're going to continue the conversation. I think it's really important to talk about insects, to talk about invertebrates, to talk about all of these beings that inhabit this planet Earth. And we need to shift our focus. We need to shift our perspective and look at these beings with wonder, with awe, with appreciation, because they do so much. And as Jonathan Balcombe had told me when we spoke, we can't live without them. They can live without us. We can't live without them. And if we don't change the way we live, if we don't change our diet, if we don't change the way we grow food, and if we don't find respect for all of these beings, we're going to wipe ourselves out. Unfortunately, through our actions, we have wiped out many species. But I have a feeling a lot of them will find their way back when the habitat for them is more welcoming. Joining me today is the author of a new book, Rebugging the Planet, The Remarkable Things That Insects and Other Invertebrates Do and Why We Need to Love Them More. I'm here with Vicki Hurd. And Vicki is head of the Sustainable Farming Campaign for SUSTAIN, the Alliance for Better Food and Farming. And she also runs an independent consultancy, an experienced and award-winning environmental campaigner, researcher, writer, and strategist working mainly in the food, farming, and environmental policy arenas. Vicki has worked on government policy for many years and is the author of Perfectly Safe to Eat, The Facts on Food. Vicki's passion is insects. The first pets she gave her children were a family of stick insects, and she received a giraffe-necked weevil tattoo for her 50th birthday. Vicki has a master's in pest management and is a fellow of the Royal Entomological Society. Thank you so much for joining me, Vicki.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Bugs, insects, and invertebrates. Before we dive into that, can we talk about what those are, invertebrates, insects, and bugs?
Yes. Yes. Well, I wanted to talk in the book about more than insects, critical though insects are, but they're one part of a much larger group of spineless beasts, ranging from, you know, lobsters all the way to your worms, to your fleas and your spiders. And all these aren't insects, but I think a lot of people sort of lump them all together and call them insects. And I wanted to sort of raise awareness of the importance of knowing all the other families that are really critical to our food system and to our lives. So, and you know, worms, I think, you know, people recognize maybe they're not insects, but I wanted to talk about worms because they're amazing. And so, yeah, it was just all of the beasts that I could fit into the book. And they're not just insects, not just, yeah.
You called invertebrates spineless beasts. Mm. And humans have this way of naming people, giving people and judging people with negative names, including spineless beasts.
Beasts, yes.
But spineless beasts do amazing things, and we can't live without them.
Yes, absolutely.
So I have a new appreciation now, and I think I'm going to try and use that term, spineless,
yes,
in a different way, if I'm going to choose to use it at all.
Yes, I suppose I used it without thinking. It does. It could be seen as a weakness, and it's not. It's their strength in a way. They're not rooted with a vertebrae and all the things that go with that. So they can do incredible maneuvers and all sorts of forms that they have reflect the fact that they're not tied to a central vertebral column.
I think this time a lot of it is all about changing. Or I want to use the word reimagining just our perspective.
Yes. I do have a chapter called Rebugging Your Attitudes.
Because that's
it. I wanted people to sort of, by reading the book and reading around the issue and taking photographs and getting involved in bug activities in your local area, understanding more about why it's best not to kill them as soon as you see them or to be revulsed and to give that revulsion to your children. I do talk about that. I think children have an incredible curiosity and love of bugs often when they're little, but it's very quickly extinguished by a parent or a carer who immediately says, don't go near it. It's dirty or it's going to sting you. And actually the majority of bugs aren't harmful. There's a, you know, 1%, 5% that are. And I think we've lumped them all together as a sort of problem, and they're really not. They're really a massive asset, and they've been here a lot longer than we have, so they know how to look after the resources that we have on this very small, thin level of topsoil that we rely on for our food and our living.
And they will probably live much longer our lifespan as humans. Before we talk about the book, can you talk about this? About the organization Sustain, the Alliance for Better Food and Farming. I remember hearing about Sustain about 20 years ago. I think that's when they got started a little bit more than that.
Yes, it got started then. I merged it. I was running an organization called Safe Alliance, which is Sustainable Agriculture, Food and Environment Alliance, with a National Food Alliance to create an Uber Alliance, because it's clear food and farming and all those issues are so complex, interrelated. If we go for single issues or one part of the system, another part of the system will fall apart. So it's a whole system approach, and it's actually grown into a very large alliance now. It's really exciting what it can do. It's about 100 organizations, non-profit, academic organizations, royal societies, farming organizations, and big conservation groups. So all of them recognize that we've got to work together to get the kind of policies and practices by government and by industry and by individuals that actually nurture a much more resilient and sustainable farming system. And so we do a lot of campaigning. So, you know, we're shouting from the rooftops for getting rid of junk food and, you know, advertising, things like that. And we'll do a lot of inside lobbying of government. And a lot of it is about networking. So we give strength by being a bigger movement and a louder voice. And that's what alliances can do. And it's had some successes. And everything is really hard. Everything is really hard to change, as you
know.
Vested interests in food and farming, which take us in the wrong direction, are very strong and powerful.
Well, Sustain, as I mentioned, has been around for a little over 20 years. And 20 years to us seems like a long time, but it really is nothing. It's really, I think changes are happening in a grand view quickly, although to us they seem quite slow.
Yeah.
Question is, are the changes going to happen in time?
Yes, that is the critical issue, because we've actually not made the big changes we could have made 20 years ago or 10 years ago that would mean it would be easier now. And particularly, exactly. Obviously, we're talking about climate change and changing the weather patterns. We could have got them less extreme if we'd started 20 years ago.
Or 30 years or 40 ago. years ago. Yeah, exactly. We've been talking about this a long time.
Exactly. And the fossil fuel industry have known for a long time what was going to happen. So they're really culpable. But we just, we are where we are. We've got to take action. And it's got to be harder action because we left it too late. And so biodiversity and wildlife, because they're such a critical part of the ecosystem on which we depend. So, yeah, it's we've got to act fast now.
You mentioned when talking about sustain about how so many things are interconnected and we tend to like to reduce and use reductionism, talk about one thing. But that one thing is always connected to something else. And the same is true about invertebrates and insects.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. When I started digging into some like keystone species, because I wanted to talk about some species that people might not have thought about, but in a way that shows that they are, really critical. And then you start to, it starts to mushroom, or what's that, like a avalon? I don't know, what's the word?
Mushroom is a great word because mushrooms are a good one, whole other subject.
Exactly. Yes, I've been reading about them. And their intimate relationship with insects and invertebrates is also very, very fascinating. But yeah, when you knock one species out, for instance, inadvertently or through chemicals or whatever, you're likely to get something coming in to take its place, and which could be just or actually even in worse problem. And that I was looking at the wood ant in the Cairngorms, which is an amazing forest system in Scotland, absolutely beautiful and luckily recognised for that and being protected and enlarged. But they found that if they took the wood ant with their nests out of the system, a pest would come along and take over. And there's loads of complex reasons for that. But when you actually look at the wood ant's nest, they have earthworms in there. They have other beetles. They have fungi. They farm fungi. They also go out and hunt other bugs and other beasts, which is partly why the moth, which was then a pest problem, got out of control. So you've got so many interactions within just one species nest. You take out the nest and you cause a huge problem. So, yes, it's all interconnected and wonderfully so. Yeah.
Yes, wonderfully so. Mm-hmm. Now, most people know that insects, especially bees, and we may not be aware that other insects as well, like flies, are responsible for pollinating a lot of our food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we some of us appreciate those insects for that. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of, in the beginning of your book, you talked about the possibility of robo-bees, not that we want that to happen, but humans, as nutty as we are, we think, oh, we could fix that problem, and if chemicals don't do it, and if this doesn't do it, let's, try robo-bees. But everything we need to survive beautifully and in balance is already here.
It is. And it self-replicates itself for free. It doesn't cause pollution. Can you imagine if we released billions of robo-bees, how much pollution that would cause? Unless they were made out of recyclable plastic, which they probably won't be. And even then, it's very polluting. I mean, the robo-bees is a story in my sort of counterfactual, if we don't manage to do what we need to do. And, it seems a bit gloomy. But I'm very keen that people carry on reading Rebugging the Planet, because it does very quickly, I hope, become more positive things you can do, why you need to do what you can do in different ways. And then at the end of the book, I do talk about, if we've done all this, how wonderful and colourful and wonderful smells and all sorts of things and the noise and everything that would be there for us. But, the robo-bees, it's similar to the insecticides or the genetically engineered plants, single issue solutions for complex systems, which we know are complex. And then you start to get on a treadmill. We know farmers have been on a pesticide treadmill for a long time. And now you've got multiple genetically engineered plants that have got multiple, not only engineered to be resistant to several different herbicides and possibly insecticides. So you can just douse the whole field with lots of different things because the original one doesn't work anymore. Why doesn't it work anymore? Because insects and weeds are brilliant at developing resistance because they multiply so quickly. They can develop resistance very, very fast. And therefore the pesticides and the genetic, the gene, single gene doesn't work anymore. So yeah, you've got to have complex solutions to complex systems that you want to nurture.
Perhaps complex solutions, but maybe the solutions are simpler if we learn to work with what was already there.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. Recognizing the complexity. Yeah. And and why you need to have, for instance, farms that have got more crops on, more diversity of crops. That's going to be one of the key things. We've invested so much in monocrops, you know, vast, huge fields of a single crop. That's just like a fantastic feast to one particular pest. Whereas if you have a range of crops and in rotations and maybe, you know, having crops that are better at stopping one particular disease or one particular pest, all those things are a reflection of farmers' knowledge over millennia. And yet they don't do it anymore because they can just sap a field with pesticides. But we know now the problem that's causing, for instance, to bees, as you mentioned, they're absolutely incredibly important to us, and they've been really damaged by neonicotinoid insecticides. So they're starting to be banned, those insecticides, as farmers need to find other tools. Yeah.
One of the things I enjoyed was the fact that you are British and I am American, and so some of the terminology is a little different. And you were talking about the ladybird, which in the United States call a ladybug.
Yes.
And I love the ladybug.
Which is slightly more accurate in a way, isn't it? It's more bug than bird. But yes.
Well, but I love the term ladybird. It really is. I mean, this particular species is beautiful. And I think.
Yes, and they are beautiful, and they're very numerous in their variety as well. There's an incredible, you know, 21 spot. And I love their name as well, Cochinilla. And so I agree. Yes, you're right. It's a beautiful name. And they're very important in all sorts of ways. We love it when we start to see ladybirds emerging in the spring. And a lot of gardeners are actually thrilled because they're brilliant at eating aphids and other pests on your rose bushes or whatever. So if you keep a balance in your garden that allows the ladybirds to survive, you'll be keeping down the aphids as well and other natural controls of the pests that you might want to keep down. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is you mentioned in your book aphids. A lot of us are familiar with aphids as gardeners. I have a balcony and, you know, we've grown a variety of things and the aphids always come. And, you know, I try and balance with different herbs and things that they're not supposed to like. But you tell us that we don't want to wipe them out.
Yes. Yes. Because then you wipe out their predators. I mean, it's a matter of balance and, you know, it's just these sort of words like balance and sharing the planet with the beasts. And if you allow a balance, more of a balance in your garden and don't wipe out all the aphids, you'll have a food source for the predators. And so if you put up with a little bit of aphids or maybe a few snails and a few, you know, to encourage the hedgehogs or other predators that you might want for the snails and slugs, it's about having that balance and leaving some of the food source for the predators of the pests that you've got. It's you know, it really can work. And we've got wonderful organic gardening organization in the UK, which does a lot of advice for farmers about these kind of things and planting in order to reduce the likelihood of losing a whole crop or a whole flower bed to one particular pest or disease.
So this brings us back to your term, rebugging your attitude. And I want to come back to that because I'm enjoying this theme as something we can apply to all life.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So every being has value, even though they may be a problem in some instances and we don't enjoy them for that. But we need to find the value in everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone and everything.
I'm calling all these species everyone. I don't call
everyone.
Them things.
Yeah, very good. Very good. they all, everyone. Yeah, we all a huge collection of animals on this planet and plants and fungi and protozoa and bacteria, all very important part of the community that and which we call this planet home. And let's face it, we've only got one. You know, we're not going to go onto another planet soon, so we ought to be living on it in a way that allows everybody to sort of live a decent life and recognizing the sentience of a lot of being. I think a lot of people don't think insects and other bugs are sentient. They don't have feelings, they don't have sensations or pain. I would challenge that. I think there's a different way they would feel things. But I think it's important to recognize that they are living beings and we should be not treating them like we belong here and they don't. We're creating the environment for a lot of them to get out of control in some ways. You know, I'm not talking about not controlling the particularly harmful insects. If they get out of control and they're transmitting diseases, we have to control that. There are ways of doing that which are less harmful to the wider environment as well. But we've spent so long in researching and spending money on ways to kill insects and other invertebrates that we've forgotten about all those that are actually important and give us the richness of the natural world in which we love.
When it comes to what an insect thinks and feels and does, I like to bring this up a lot. I have no idea what you're thinking. I have no idea what's in your head, and nobody knows what's in my head. I'm the only one who knows, maybe.
Sometimes I'm confused about what I think, yes.
So how can we possibly imagine or think that we know anything about anyone else? And that means a fly or a bee or a dog or a cat, anyone, any of these beings. We have no idea. We have no idea what reality is to anyone but ourselves, if we even know what our own reality is.
Yes. And we don't really look after ourselves that well either, do we?
There's that.
And I think looking after ourselves better actually would be better for the planet, you know, because, you know, that's what I talk about in the chapter about inequality and excessive consumption and power. All those things matter to the bugs, but they also matter to us. Actually, if we look after ourselves better and have less inequality and less overconsumption of things, we actually create an environment for people and all the other wonderful creatures on the planet. All of us would be better looked after. And that's, you know, it's about waste, it's about overconsumption, it's about fairness. So all these things people might not expect to find in a book about bugs, but it's there because it's important.
Is it that surprising a discovery that things that benefit other things on this planet also benefit us?
Yeah. I think there's a number of people out there that wouldn't necessarily agree with that yet. You know, we can impose our will. And we have been imposing our will on the natural environment and therefore being able to feed a lot more people on this planet. You know, the artificial fertilizers and chemicals and breeding that we've done in farming over the last century have created far more food for a lot more people to survive on this planet. But at the same time, we've forgotten that actually we should be sharing it better between us and between us and the other living beings. And I just think we've got tipped over the balance in terms of consumption and waste in a way that nobody's really realized yet, you know, just in terms of plastic, but also food waste and the amount of materials we consume on a daily basis is deeply harmful to the biodiversity as well as our own well-being, really.
Early in the book, and you talk about it, I think later in the book as well, one of the solutions that people come up with that we actually hear about in mainstream media is edible insect food products for protein, because so many people are obsessed with protein and think we cannot get enough protein. I can't say enough how much I don't support this idea. I'm a vegan, so eating insects is not for me. And this whole idea of protein, the plant kingdom is providing plenty of protein for everybody. So this upsets me, and it upsets me in many ways because it goes back to that concept of exploiting. And if we were going to do this, grow insects in massive amounts to make protein, that's another thing that'll bring the balance out of itself.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a huge amount of investment going into huge factories to produce billions of insects a day, the maggots, particularly of black soldier fly, in order to produce a feed for animals. And those animals are kept in intensive farming conditions. Yeah. So it's perpetuating a system which is totally unsustainable. Factory farming, intensive livestock. livestock systems, which we've created only in the last 50 years, 60 years, in a way which is totally unsustainable because it uses so much land. But on top of that, there's the cruelty, the diseases, inhumanity to the animals and the workers in the system across the whole food system. Anyway, you know about this, but actually making it easier by saying, oh, well, we won't use soya from South America, which is destroying rainforests. We'll breed a load of insects instead. And I think that's just, as you say, it's just creating another imbalance. There's loads of issues around the actual system itself. There's welfare issues. There's water, potentially. What's the food source for the insects issues? But on top of that, if it's perpetuating a really intensive farming system, that's, you know, it's not good and it's cruel. And as you say, we don't need it. It's obsession, I agree with you about protein. We've got perfectly good amounts of protein. So I think my jury's out in a sense when it comes to eating insects as food directly. I've got a friend who's breeding insects in a very humane way, and she's creating cricket powder and for direct consumption, for people who recognise what they're doing, but also 2 billion people on this planet do eat insects on a regular basis. And of course, when we're eating prawns and crustacea, you don't eat those, but obviously many people do. They're already eating invertebrates. So it's something that I think is slightly different, but it should absolutely be done sustainably and humanely if we're going to do it. But I don't agree with producing insects as feed. But it's a huge industry and there's a huge propulsion for some environmental groups to actually promote this as a solution to soya as a bad food source. So yeah, it's a big problem.
So I think it's pretty obvious that humans are the problem. And you list a number of things that are causing this genocide, shall we say, of insects, of bugs, industrial farming of crops and livestock, mining, urban development. These all impact the habitat of our tiny little friends. And then we are responsible for air and soil and water pollution. These affect everyone. Again, when I say everyone, I mean all of the invertebrates and everything that inhabits this planet. And then we have our favorite subject of climate change and temperature shifting. One thing I was interested that you listed in addition to light and noise is the 5G for cell phones. And there have been a lot of conspiracy theories, maybe some of them are supported, about how we should really fear 5G. But you mentioned something that was important that caught my eye.
Yes, I was surprised about this. And it came up as I was doing the research for the book. I wasn't looking for it. But it's, you know, it's the way in which the ever increasing frequency of phone signals and Wi-Fi signals that we're using, there's a lot of energy in those signals. And when small little creatures are exposed to that kind of high level frequency, the energy, there's a suggestion that it might be heating up and cooking the insects. So I'm talking about whether we're cooking the bees, and I really don't think enough research has been done. And even if it has, is anybody in power listening? So we might need to be campaigning on this. I don't know about all the other conspiracy theories. I'm so focused on the bugs that I'm thinking about in that context. We really should be pausing possibly on that widespread take up of 5G and 6G and 7G and all the other Gs, because it's being rolled out without that concern. So yeah, but I think the other issue which people don't think about is plastic pollution. And of course, when we're creating tiny bits of plastic in the water, in the seas, and evidence is showing that it's extraordinarily everywhere and in our stomachs, even in breast milk. You can imagine how it's filling the stomachs of bugs as well in a horrible way. And they're obviously at the base of the food chain for a lot of other animals. The fish, the birds, the seabirds, all the animals that depend on bugs as food. They'll be ingesting that plastic pollution. And with the plastic pollution, you can get chemicals and contaminants, because they provide a surface area for toxic chemicals. So there's a huge number of concerns that are absolutely definite about microplastics that come from our clothes, come from our packaging, come from our plastic filled lives that we've really got to turn away from. I'm sure you agree with that. Yes,
I absolutely do agree. And I've been trying to unplastic my life.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's great. Everybody can. It's not impossible, is it? It's really not.
No,
there's more and more refills available and things like that.
But what is out there to clean up the microplastic that we've already created? Now, my hope is that there's some fabulous fungi out there that can munch all that up and turn it into something useful.
Yes. They might be already there doing it. It's quite possible because fungi are incredible.
Yes. Yeah, I've read little things here and there that are inspiring.
They are. I mean, it might be that you need the combination of all the different animals, like the, I don't know, I was thinking the insects that do such, that's breaking down leaf litter into smaller pieces for the fungi and the microbes to do their work, to release the nutrients in leaf litter and plant matter. They could be doing the same with plastics. But I don't know. I think, you know, it's got a bit out of control. There's so much out there. You know, on the water, the riverbeds and seabeds, it's quite frightening. So we need to act pretty fast on that. And one of the ways is actually not necessarily buying clothes made with fossil fuels, like polyester and things like that. Because when you wash them and dry, if you dry them in a machine, it releases loads of tiny little particles. So that's one of the things I talk about in the book, and about what you buy in general, both in food and clothing and furniture, and trying to reuse, recycle, refurbish, rather than always go for new. It's very, very important.
When I first got the book, I thought it was going to be a quick read.
It took me
longer because there really is a lot of information in here.
Yeah.
But what some of the things that I liked, one is the page numbering.
Oh, yes.
You have adorable little insects next to the numbers on every page.
Yes, sweet, aren't they? They're very good. Very good. Tiny little insects, yeah. They might be mites, actually. I think they might be mites.
They might be what?
Yeah, spider mites, they look like, actually.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And then on the beginning of the boxes with the, like, little fat boxes or the tips, we've got little grubs as well, which is great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm glad you liked that.
I did. And I also enjoyed those little gray boxes with the little facts and different stories about individual invertebrates, insects, bugs that are so fascinating.
Yeah.
And such a wealth of intelligence that we really need to learn from. Yeah. And you mentioned in the book that we are learning here and there bits about things that bugs do that we can learn from, like the tensile strength of a spider's thread.
Absolutely. Stronger than steel. Yeah. Incredible.
Stronger than steel.
Yes. It's amazing. And there's a lot of work and research going on. Like, for instance, how a fly is able to fly upside down and maneuver so brilliantly. It's taken scientists a lot to actually understand how they could mimic that in a drone if they want to build drones that are much more maneuverable. And if there's a big if as whether we should, but putting that aside, we are learning from them. And there was a wonderful beast called the diabolical ironclad beetle. I don't know if you spotted that. And it's got a exoskeleton, which is the shell that they have around the beetles, which is so strong. It's made up of interweaving layers of proteins, which are so strong you can't squash it. The beetle is so incredibly strong. So they're learning about how that complex matrix is formed in order to produce stronger materials. But I think also for me, one of the ways in which we can learn is about reducing waste and living with each other, communicating better, understanding how we should be looking after this nest that we've created as humans, you know, our nests, in a way which is far more efficient and sustainable and doesn't destroy the nests of other inhabitants on this planet. So, you know, and it's about communication as well as understanding each other's role in doing the things that we do on the planet. So I found it quite, I had a very, very long chapter on what we learn from bugs, and it's been shortened for the book. I think I might publish it as a blog one day because there's lots and lots of things. I looked at all the hierarchy of needs that Maslow, a scientist, had developed, the hierarchy of needs that we have, from basic needs like food and water and shelter, all the way to psychological needs of well-being and belonging. And I went through all of them and said how insects and bugs do it. It was quite fascinating to find some. connections. And yeah, we could learn a lot from watching invertebrates.
Well, I would love to see us looking more into this, but using the knowledge for good things.
Yes,
I can't help but think in this capitalistic, war-loving society that we would use some of the things that we learned about strength and
and
lightweight materials that are really strong for
nanomaterials,
killing each other, right?
Yeah.
And instead, there's so much information that we could learn. You called it swarm intelligence, where we would have better communication and feedback. We could share labor and responsibilities. And when I think of humans in a crowd, it brings out all of our worst characteristics. Mm. We are not good in swarms.
No, that's true. That's true. We're not good in cars either. I notice when people get into cars behind the wheel, we get aggressive. And I'm the best. I can be in control. So yeah, it's learning a certain amount of humility and but not accumulating. It's accumulating stuff and wealth and power, which I think it feels like it's got completely out of control. No, I agree with you. When I talked about the diabolical ironclad beetle, yes, I was thinking they're going to be creating tanks that are stronger. That's not what we need. And buildings. They're seeing how buildings can be created using more flexible materials that the termites or other builders in the insect world do so well. But should we be creating such huge buildings? So yeah, but we could learn from them in terms of having very clever heat exchange and saving water and saving energy in ways that termites do brilliantly in their nests, which is quite extraordinary to learn about.
You know, I wonder, we don't know what these
we don't know anything,
but we don't know what these insects think. And I'm imagining that they're thinking, oh, these humans, when are they going to learn? We put it all out there in front of them for them to use. And they just mess everything up.
Yeah.
I'm curious. You mentioned termites a few times in the book and how they can teach us a lot of things about maintaining temperature and humidity and building construction. But we find termites destroy our homes. Are there other things that termites do that are useful?
I think they are important in terms of soil and nutrient distribution in systems where they're living in harmony. Obviously, we build homes with the kind of materials that they want to build their homes with. So they then take our materials and they can be hugely destructive. Yes, I talk about that. The billions in lost buildings and villages having to be abandoned because termites are taken over. But they are a very important part of the ecosystem in many parts of the globe. And they provide the way in which they move nutrients around the system through their tunnels and everything. That's an important part of the ecosystem. Keeping termites out is one of the key tools, I guess, to stop them taking too much. But it's a balance to be struck, I think, and using materials they don't necessarily need might be a better way of doing it. Tricky. Termites are very, very, very clever.
Well, I would like to see a blog article on the African dung beetle. You say that they use the Milky Way to navigate, and I wanted to hear more about that.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? It's the only known insect that does that we know about, but probably there's others doing it. We just haven't investigated it.
Sure.
So they can find their way to the right, places they know are going to be useful to go to, navigating by the stars.
That's incredible. I was reading about or watching a video recently about birds using magnetic fields to help them navigate. So much to learn from.
Yes, there is. I mean, at beetles, there's that wonderful beetle that goes up onto the dunes and has an incredible system where it collects dew in the beginning of the morning in the hottest places in Africa, in the sand dunes. And so it can survive because it goes up in the morning and does all the right behaviors to collect as much water as it needs and then goes back down again when it gets hot. And there's we can learn so much.
And once again, I want to underline that we cannot live without these species. We cannot live without bugs who are removing and converting and consuming waste, a lot of it made by us.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, all our dead bodies, where would they go without the bugs? They have to be broken down by the flies and the beetles and broken down into the manageable morsels that then bacteria and other smaller creatures can then dissolve. We would be knee deep in the mess and waste and manure if those bugs weren't doing what we need them to. It's incredibly vital purpose that people don't often know about, I think. That and the water, they're really important for keeping water clean. They take the nasties in the water system and convert them into useful nutrients.
So this word rebug, did you coin that word, or is that a word that has been used before?
I haven't seen it used before. When I thought of it, I'd been looking at a book called Rebirding, which was published a couple of years ago, and was talking about how birds are a critical part of the rewilding picture, you know, creating more natural systems, leaving nature to do its bit, and birds being a very critical part of that. I was thinking, well, the birds absolutely need the bugs. They either eat them directly or they eat the seeds and the fruits and the plants that the bugs either pollinate or support through the soil processes. So I thought, well, if we can have a book called Rebirding, why don't we have a book called Rebugging? And in fact, I was thinking of just doing an article about rebugging, and I listed 50 ways you can help the bugs. I thought it'd be useful sort of tips and a blog or something like that, but it got a little bit out of control, as things didn't do, and there's so much to say that I was talking to a publisher and they said, well, that would make a good book. So hence the Rebugging the Planet book. But it's quite a useful phrase, because you can say, oh, I'm going to rebug my home, I'm going to rebug my diet, I'm going to rebug my school, I'm going to rebug my workplace. So it's, you know, it's quite handy in many ways.
Yes, it's time to elevate the image of the insect in our
recognize what you can
in
do
our society
to help them.
So you talk about rewilding, and we can do that in a small space, in a large space. What I really love about rewilding is it brings back beauty.
Absolutely.
And there's so much ugliness in the world with manufacturing factories. And when we rewild, we can create so much beauty around everything that we've created, including big farms, which are not beautiful.
Yeah.
And which
People
are not
make
healthy
them beautiful.
For us.
Yeah, they're not healthy. I mean, there's a lot of interest in the farming community in the UK, and I imagine in the US, in creating a far more sustainable farming system. And that would be, I think, more beautiful, but also messy. I think messiness in nature is beautiful. And, you know, when you get the cracks in the pavement and a little plant grows in it, that's going to be an amazing food source for a bug. And actually, I think it's beautiful. Obviously, you know, there's issues if the whole pavement cracks open, you know, you have to keep it within processes that can work. But then why have a pavement? Why not have a grassy verge that everybody walks on? Anyway, you know, there's whole ways we can think about our community, our homes, as a rewilding place. And I think the other thing, as well as beauty and sounds and smells that come with that, which are fantastic, there's also surprises. You know, I think one of the things a lot of people involved in rewilding, big rewilding projects, things happen that they weren't expecting at all. And often it's to do with the insects that come in and they take over, and then another insect comes in and controls it, you know, without you interfering, it starts to create the balance. And I think that can happen on a small scale, in your garden, in your park. I think we can create some really good surprises for people by rebugging and putting in flowers and more trees, more shrubs.
What fascinates me, and you mentioned being surprised by it when in your garden, is you create a habitat that is friendly. And the insects find it.
Yes.
The invertebrates find it.
How do they find it?
How do they do that?
Yeah. Are they flying all the time? But some of them aren't flying insects. You know, some of them are just...
How do the worms find it?
The worms, yeah.
How do they find it?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got water snails now, and I just built a tiny little pond in lockdown last year. How did the water snails find my pond? There's no pond nearby. I'm surrounded by concrete gardens, so I'm a little refuge. But, you know, that's one of the problems we've got, is that we've lost a lot of the corridors that insects can travel through and move through, as well as other animals and birds, etc. Those corridors, natural corridors. We've got a big campaign here called Beelines, which is creating beelines for pollinators like bees. And it's like making sure you've got bits of green so they can move through the environment and recolonize, find mates, find new food sources and all that kind of thing. I feel that in a way, if I'm a little refuge, but if I'm surrounded by concrete, then it's quite difficult for them to move around. But they do seem to manage it. You're right. They seem to get around.
I'm wondering, we don't know this, but maybe they work together somehow where a flying insect will see a habitat and think, that would be good for my friend the worm. I'm going to pick up some of this larvae and drop it here or something.
Yeah, it's possible. It possibly happens by accident or design, who knows? Yeah, on their feet. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. There's an amazing story in the press today about some 30 years ago, some butterflies were reintroduced to an island. I think it was in Australasia. And they didn't realize at the time, but with the butterflies, they were reintroducing a parasitic wasp species in some of the larvae. And also in those parasitic wasp larvae, there was an even smaller wasp larvae. And on that, there was bacteria and all those 30 years ago arrived in this island in a way that they didn't expect. They thought they were just reintroducing the butterfly. And it created an incredible ecosystem that has actually survived. You know, you know, the systems come and go and you have crashes in populations, but the actual butterfly and the wasps are still there. In ways which show that they can create a balance in an island system.
Incredible.
Quite incredible, yeah. And it's always, even if you're looking at a microscopic level, there's always something even smaller. It's just amazing. Something inhabiting.
I wanted to talk about golf courses for a moment. You mentioned them. And I remembered talking about golf courses some 10, 20 years ago about how much pesticides and herbicides they use. Mm-hmm. And there were movements to get them to stop doing that. But you recommend things that are even bigger. Golf courses take up a big amount
of huge land take. They do. And you could argue that for the number of people using them, there's an inequality there. You know, people don't have access to that golf course who should have access to nature and access to spaces, green spaces for their well-being, mental and physical well-being, particularly in urban areas. If you've got golf courses in urban areas, they should possibly be green spaces for everybody to access. I do talk about there are good biodiverse rich golf courses that I did find out about where they are managed in a way that really isn't hostile to invertebrates. But you're right, when you've got the green, you know, it's you know, when you see something like, I look at something like that and it's just one monocultural grass, it fills me with horror, and you know there's going to be loads of chemicals to make it perfect like that and fertilizers, etc. So I think, you know, we should possibly be pulling away from any more golf courses. But if we are having golf courses, they should be as biodiverse as possible, and really rich biodiversity in the refuges. And in fact, when you look at some of the data, some of the spaces on the golf course can be incredibly important refuges for bugs. You know, the places that are rough and the places that are left, like small woodlands and stuff, are very important. Particularly if it's in an urban area or around an urban area, can be a very important refuge. But also gardens can be, and parks, you know, municipal parks can be managed in such a way that's fantastically important for invertebrates.
So much to do.
Yes, that's it. And if we all chip in with a bit of our time, a bit of our energy, and a bit of our power as citizens, you know, saying to your local authority, I want this park to be rich in wildflowers because I want it to have pollinators in it, not to be just a boring monoculture lawn. If you, along with loads of other people, say that, you'll get a change. And that's what I'm, you know, I do talk about a lot of tips. And then at the end of the book, there's lots of tips about how you can get engaged in those kind of things in a way which you join with others. You don't have to do it all yourself.
Absolutely. That's what everyone needs to know, that there are things that we can do, small steps and big steps.
Absolutely.
And even though it's important to change policy, which is really critical, and we need to be writing our representatives and campaigning and getting involved in different movements, there are so many things we can do right in our own homes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But a lot of tips throughout the book about things you can do in your own home. And it's not just what you can do in your garden or your windowsill, but it's about what you buy, how you cook, what you cook and where you buy your food from. And, you know, all those kind of things, they all make a difference. And if you're really supporting great farmers, you're making a huge difference. You're being a citizen consumer and you're voting with your purse. And equally, there's a lot more organic cotton around now. So you can buy organic cotton material if you have to buy new clothes. Then supporting those kind of farmers here and overseas is hugely important. So, but as I say in the book, the most sustainable piece of clothing that you have now is probably the one you're wearing. You know, wear it out. Don't buy a new one.
Right. Wear it out. Maybe that's why I'm not really into this fashion of ripped jeans.
No.
But maybe wearing our jeans and let them rip and wear them out rather than buying them new and ripped.
Yes, absolutely. And you can patch them with fun patches. I'd like that to be part of, you know, a status thing for you to be wearing clothes for a long time and furniture for a long time. You can refurbish things and or share it and exchange it. If you're bored with it, exchange it for something else. Don't throw it away. Don't throw it in the bin. It's the last thing. We should get rid of bins. There should be no bins, don't you think? You have to recycle everything you want to throw away in some way. It would be interesting to try that.
So much to do. So we need to be avoiding plastic, eating organic, eating a diverse diet, which is good for us, fruits
less
and vegetables.
Junk, less junk.
Yeah. Less processed foods.
Yes.
You know, you mentioned the 10 companies that control almost all of the
brands,
processed foods, large food and beverage brands in the world: Nestle, PepsiCo, Coca-Cola, Unilever, Danone, General Mills, Kellogg's, Mars, Associated British Foods, and Mondelez. I don't buy anything from any of those companies, I recommend that we all avoid them.
Yeah, buy fresh if you can. It's cheaper in the end.
Seasonal, locally, absolutely. There are so many things that we can do, and diversity is best. You know, why do we need uniformity in our potato? We need potatoes of many colors.
Exactly the same. Exactly. It's
why
apples.
We've been taught to like that, and we need to get back to appreciating variety.
Absolutely. Right. The old blemish means it hasn't been covered in chemicals. It's a good thing, I guess.
Anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Vicky Hurd, and reading your book, Rebugging the Planet, The Remarkable Things That Insects and Other Invertebrates Do, and Why We Need to Love Them More. It comes out on September 21st.
So it's coming out on Thursday in the UK, but I think 21st in America,
Yes. Okay, excellent. And I wish you the best and hope that we can make a difference here for all
of
us.
Thank you. And thank you for reading and asking great questions and everything you do. Sounds fantastic.
Thank you. We're in this together.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all on one home.
That's right. One home, planet Earth. Yeah. Okay, take care. Be well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. That was Vicky Hurd, the author of Rebugging the Planet, The Remarkable Things That Insects and Other Invertebrates Do, and Why We Need to Love Them More. There's lots of fascinating information in this book about invertebrates, insects, and bugs. I wanted to talk about a few things that are going on and resources that you may be interested in that support invertebrates. Here in New York City, we have a public park called the High Line. It's built on a 1.45-mile-long elevated rail structure running from the Gansevoort Street to 34th Street on Manhattan's west side. Perhaps you've heard about it. It's really a lovely spot. It was founded by neighborhood residents in 1999 to prevent the elevated rail track from being demolished. And I just love that whole concept. It's a beautiful spot. In September, the High Line has an annual event. It's a month-long horticulture celebration, and it highlights a different aspect of the park's horticulture and sustainability initiatives. It's inspired by
the artist Cecilia Vicuña's day-long festival, Insectageddon. And this year, the park is taking a closer look at the relationship between insects, plants, and the greater web of life, including humans. And that's what we're talking about. And they have a number of events. This is really exciting. They have Saturday art workshops. Two of them have already taken place, but there's one more on September 18th. And this is for families, teens, and adults. And then there's the Insectageddon on September 25th. I'm including a link for the High Line if you're interested in that. There's also a resource called Invertebrate Welfare at invertebratewelfare.org. And they describe themselves saying, from insects to octopi to lobsters, the overwhelming majority of animals on Earth are invertebrates. But animal welfare research outside minor explorations of cephalopod sentience primarily focuses on vertebrates such as pets and livestock. This site is a compilation of research on the scale and nature of invertebrate welfare and the human industries that harm or farm them. There's lots of great information there. I hope you check it out. And then just more things to think about, right? There are so many things that affect all these beings on the planet that humans are responsible for. There was an article that recently came out in BBC.com about light pollution, and light pollution from street lamps linked to insect loss. From the article, scientists say that light pollution may be contributing to worrying declines in insects seen in recent decades. In a UK study, artificial streetlights were found to disrupt the behavior of nocturnal moths, reducing caterpillars' numbers by half. Modern LED streetlights appear to have the biggest impact. If you want to know more about that, I will include a link in the post for this program. But it seems that so many things that we do to make human life more comfortable, easier, perhaps more efficient, and that's a word you know I don't like. These things have tremendous damage on the planet. It's time to find our way back to benefit, our way back to nurture this planet that is trying to nurture us. I hope you've enjoyed this program about invertebrates, insects, bugs. Be nice to those flies and those gnats in your kitchen. You've been listening to another episode of It's All About Food, broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network. Thanks, everybody at the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. We appreciate you. This program is brought to you by Responsible Eating and Living, a nonprofit that gives you the truth and tools for a healthy vegan lifestyle. And you can find us at responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can always send us comments and questions at info@realmeals.org. Have a delicious week, everybody.